From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Beat Writers, we feature an interview with Allen Ginsberg and hear a 1956 reading of his classic poem Howl, which is collected in a CD box of readings that span his career. Then we hear from the writer Ginsberg called an American literary cultural hero, poet Gary Snyder. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book Turtle Island. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Call Me Burroughs, a reissue of readings by William Burroughs recorded in 1965. Also today, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new interactive film, Mr. Payback. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Housing Secretary Henry Cisneros is criticizing proposed housing cuts by Republicans. He told Fox TV today the $7 billion cut Republicans want is unfair. Cisneros says that could force thousands of people onto the streets. He says the cuts are 10 times larger than what President Clinton wants, and Cisneros says this is a slash-and-burn approach by the Republicans. The GOP says the cuts are necessary if federal housing programs will ever truly help the poor. House GOP leaders expect to approve more than $17 billion in deep, immediate cuts to several federal programs. France and the United States traded angry words today over a growing spy scandal. Paris is demanding that four U.S. diplomats and a fifth U.S. citizen leave the country on charges of spying. The controversy has soured relations between the two countries. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Interior Minister Charles Pasqua said in an interview in the Paris Daily Le Monde that the charges against the five Americans were very, very serious. He insinuated that Washington, and not France, was responsible for leaking the affair. The story first came out in Le Monde, which managed to get a hold of a French Secret Service report. Pasqua's ministry is in charge of the Secret Services. In an unusual move, the American Embassy in Paris released a statement in reaction to Pasqua's comments. It said his charge that Washington had leaked the report was neither true nor credible. Commentators in France suspect Pasqua could have been responsible for leaking the story. It came at a time when he was under fire at home for a wiretapping scandal. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Police in Paterson, New Jersey are trying to help settle unrest stemming from the shooting of a black teenager this week. Tony Randolph of member station WBGO reports.
A Paterson City Councilwoman promised that the violence has ended in the city. For the past two nights, there have been disturbances followed by a display of police force. Vera Ames, who is also a cousin of the victim, said she's asked the police not to ride through the streets in riot gear, saying that antagonizes young people. Ames addressed classmates of the victim this morning to ask them to stop the violence. She says they listened because students canceled today's protest. Students will get together again on Sunday for a prayer vigil. For National Public Radio, I'm Tony Randolph in Paterson, New Jersey.
The man accused of masterminding the World Trade Center bombing has a new lawyer. The court has appointed Roy Kulksar to represent Ramzi Ahmed Youssef. Kulksar says Youssef considers himself a political prisoner and plans a vigorous defense. Youssef is accused of directing the bombing 2 years ago that killed six people at the Trade Center and left more than 1,000 injured. He was arrested in Pakistan 2 weeks ago and brought to the United States to face trial. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher. The Dow set another record, closing up 8.5 points to finish at 4,011.74. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. President Clinton insists he's not backing down from supporting affirmative action. Mr. Clinton has ordered a review of all affirmative action programs. Administration officials say they hope to head off an expected Republican assault on the programs. Mr. Clinton says his goal is to find out what works and what doesn't. He says that doesn't mean he's forsaking the Democratic Party's historic support for affirmative action. Reverend Jesse Jackson has criticized the president's stance. He says Mr. Clinton should be defending affirmative action, not reviewing it. Jackson is a possible Democratic presidential challenger. Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary will return home from China with newly secured energy deals worth more than $4 billion. Meanwhile, American and Chinese trade representatives are negotiating right down to the wire over the current trade dispute. The BBC's Carrie Gracie reports from Beijing.
On several occasions over the past 3 years, Sino-American trade negotiations have continued right up until the last day before an American deadline, and the same will be true again this time. If agreement is not reached on Saturday, both sides have promised to impose automatic punitive trade sanctions on the other. Negotiators are tight-lipped. No one is prepared to trade specific issues in public, but the areas of concern are well known to all. The United States wants concrete Chinese promises to prevent piracy of copyrighted American music, films, and computer software. At the end of today's session in Beijing, the chief American negotiator said progress was being made.
Carrie Gracie reporting. The country's largest black religious denomination has announced it will support Dr. Henry Foster for Surgeon General. One official of the National Baptist Convention, USA, says Foster deserves credit for working against teen pregnancy. The group says Foster's been attacked by the, quote, more rabid elements of the religious right. Foster's come under heavy fire by anti-abortion activists for performing abortions and giving different accounts of how many he did. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix.
That's Allen Ginsberg giving his first complete reading of his now classic poem, Howl. This historic recording was made by a photographer in the audience at Berkeley's Town Hall Theater in 1956. It's included on a new box set called Holy Soul Jelly Roll, which collects Ginsberg's poems and songs as recorded between 1949 and 1993. Writing about the collection in the New York Times, critic Ken Tucker described it as an immensely enjoyable time capsule of the way poetry and pop culture have interacted for half a century. Allen Ginsberg changed the course of American poetry. He made poetry an essential part of beat culture, then hippie culture, and is now at the age of 68 a father figure to many performance poets. We invited him to talk with us about his new box set retrospective. Let's start with Howl, which was partly inspired by Ginsberg's mother, who had been in a mental hospital.
She had been there for several years, and I had put her there after a breakthrough of sort of very violent behavior toward her sister and a cousin she was staying with. And then I had gone out to San Francisco, but the grief was very much on my mind. I had a friend, Carl Solomon, with whom I had been in a mental hospital 6 years before, and he was back also in Pilgrim State, too. So I addressed the poem ostensibly to him, but the emotions were, I think, directed toward my mother, both grief and a sense of solidarity.
Yeah, you know, part one begins with one of your most famous lines.
Yeah.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness.
Starving, hysterical, naked. The original phrase was starving, mystical, naked, but I figured that was a little bit too simple-minded. Because the problem was not all the problem of society. It was also the neurosis of the people. So there's a certain ironic edge to it, which I don't think critics at the time realized. I said starving, hysterical, naked. So it wasn't just a one-dimensional protest for the safety of madmen. It was also like trying to give a quick sketches of a series of cases that I drew from real life.
And what is part two, Moloch, about to you?
That kind of name, the Moloch attempts to name the social crisis and the illness of the society and the individual, pointing out that it's the desensitization caused by hyper-mechanization and hyper-industrialization, that people have become robots. Moloch is originally from the Bible, a false god to whom the tribes were sacrificing their children. The original idea is a sort of a devil goat with horns and seven furnaces, brass furnaces in the belly. And children would sacrifice parents would sacrifice their children to Moloch as a sort of god of war. And in a sense, that was happening in America at that time. There was a buildup of the war machine, the beginnings of the crisis that led to the Indo-Chinese wars that wasted the nation and, I think, caused the fall of America in the long run.
Let me play some of the Moloch section from Howl.
Moloch!
whose fate is a cloud of sexless hydrogen. Moloch, whose name is a mine. Moloch, in whom I sit lonely. Moloch, in whom I dream angels. Crazy in Moloch. Sucker in Moloch. Black love and manless in Moloch. Moloch, who entered my soul early. Moloch, in whom I am a consciousness without a body. Moloch, who burns down the love of the world. Moloch, whom I abandon.
You're reading changes in this part of the poem. It sounds more like an incantation, and your voice changes, too.
Yes, I think it gets to some sort of emotional, giving out, opening up of emotion, both my own feeling of solitude, loneliness, disorientation, and at the same time, a reliance on my own feelings as being real. So it's a sort of a realization of my own perceptions and feelings as not only being real, but probably shared by many other people.
Now, I want to move on to another poem, America, that was read the same night as Howl.
First unveiling of that poem. It's really funny. The text in the recording differs a little from the final text that I wound up with.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few extra, some very funny lines, actually.
Yeah, it really is very funny, and you get a lot of laughs from the audience.
Well, it sounds like a stand-up comedy routine. That's the era, actually, of Lenny Bruce around San Francisco. He was playing, I think, at the Purple Onion, and I went down to see him and watch his act, actually. But I hadn't expected that kind of reaction. And I didn't think the poem was that good, nor did Kerouac. It was just sort of like a joke, you know, like a takeoff, send-up of America, very lighthearted. But it's done with many different voices in a kind of schizophrenic persona. You know, 1 minute serious, 1 minute faggoty, 1 minute desperate, 1 minute religious, 1 minute patriotic, 1 minute I'm putting my queer shoulder to the wheel.
Why don't we hear the beginning of America, as you read it in 1956 at Town Hall in Berkeley.
America, I've given you all, and now I'm nothing. America, $2.27, January 17th, 1956. America, I can't stand my own mind. America, when will we end the human war? Go f*** yourself with your atom bomb. I don't feel good. Don't bother me. I won't write my poem until I'm in my right mind. When will you be angelic? When will you take off your clothes? When will you look at yourself through the grave? When will you be worthy of your million Christs? America, why are your libraries full of tears? America, when will you send your eggs to India? I'm sick of your insane demands. When will you reinvent the heart? When will you manufacture lambs? When will your cowboys reach Spengler? When will your dams release the flood of eastern tears? When will your technicians get drunk and abolish money? When will you institute religions of perception in your legislatures? When can I go into the supermarket and buy what I need with my good looks? America, after all, it is you and I who are perfect, not the next world. Your machinery is too much for me. I don't want to work for a living. You made me want to be a saint. There must be some other way to settle this argument.
Allen Ginsberg recorded in 1956. That's one of the recordings featured on his new box set, Holy Soul Jelly Roll. You know, you must have seen yourself as a provocateur in a way at a very young age. I'm thinking, you know, that you were just coming from a place that was not average. You know, your mother was mentally ill. Your mother had been a communist. You were gay. You were an intellectual. You loved poetry. I mean,
but
just everything about your life kind of set you apart.
But you got to realize, by this time, I had already known William Burroughs and Jack Kerouac 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
This is not, you know, some sudden discovery of community or ideas. We had had a long period of privacy and silence to ripen our art, to know each other and to amuse each other and to understand each other's language and intelligence and sort of enlarge our own consciousness with the experience of others. Also, I'd already had some sort of natural religious experience, and we had all by this time tried out some of the psychedelic drugs in addition, on top of a natural religious experience that was without drugs, and already had traveled a bit. And so we were, I wasn't a young kid then, I was 28 years old. You know, it was quite a ripe time.
It, was it surprising to you to find people like Burroughs and Kerouac, who you felt this kind of friendship and aesthetic closeness with?
No, it was just some sort of natural kinship that we felt almost instantly on meeting.
But did you expect you'd ever find that?
Not exactly, but I hadn't even conceived of such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I conceived of friends, and I'd had friends in high school, but I was still in the closet. Kerouac was the first person I was able to come out of the closet to and tell him about it, and actually slept with him once or twice, though he was primarily straight. But he was very tender toward me, and he saw that I was in solitary and in a great deal of confusion and anguish, and he took a sort of kindly view. Burroughs was always brought out front and clear and lucid and intelligent, as he is now. At the age of 80, he was so. At the age of 34, I think he was then. So I was lucky when I was 17 that I met people whose genius sort of ignited my own talents to, and sort of upgraded, I think, my own natural intelligence. But I'm really a student of Kerouac and of Burroughs, and in some respects an imitator. I've had a steadier life, and so I'm perhaps more on the scene as now, on the air, or going around giving readings, but I feel myself basically a pupil of Kerouac's ear, and his intelligence and language, and his awareness of the pronunciation of consonants.
Well, when you talk about being a student of Kerouac's, I've never been able to tell how much your style of reading influenced him and how much his style of reading influenced you.
Oh, I think his style influenced me. It was way back in 47, 48, I heard him read Shakespeare aloud. And it was such an interesting intonation that he put into a soliloquy of Hamlet, I think, where Hamlet is sitting down on the steps saying, what am I, you know, what am I doing? Am I nothing but a John of Dreams? And the way Kerouac said, a John of Dreams, it was like his mind went off into a little dream at it in that phrase. So I began seeing that there were intonations, differences of pitch possible. You know, most poetry still is pronounced in a monotone or a duotone, it's like I'm talking now in a sort of monotone. But there are possibilities in conversation where you go from, you know, a little high woodle when you're talking to a little baby to down to very serious heart tones when you're talking to your grandmother and on her last days on earth.
Of course, with your readings, I always felt that there was a certain Hebraic intonation, even though I know that, you know, Buddhism was probably an even greater influence on you, and you certainly hear that in your voice, too, but there is that kind of Hebraic
sound. The Hebraic thing is very real. Mm-hmm. My grandfathers were rabbis, and one of the most strong musical influence I ever had was the hearing of a recording of Sophie Breslau, a great operatic singer, singing Eli Eli, with a kind of melismus, I guess you'd call it, sort of a very beautiful way of bending the notes that's characteristic of Hebrew melody.
Now, when did that start to enter your reading style?
Well, certainly with Kaddish, because I was imitating the davening motion of Kaddish with the sound of Yishgadal, Yishgadas, Yishaleh, Yishalol, Smeid, Kushu, Bruku. Da-da-da, 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 magnificent, mourn no more, martyr of heart, mind behind, married, dream, mortal changed.
Hmm.
That is the whole rhythm of the poem has a kind of combination of Ray Charles, I Got a Woman, Yes Indeed, Yes Indeed, Yes Indeed, and which I'd been hearing the morning before I wrote the poem, and a rhythm of the original Hebrew Kaddish that was still running through my mind and body. For the first time I'd heard it, actually. A Jewish friend played it to me in dawn light the morning that I started writing the poem.
And the Kaddish is the Hebrew prayer for the dead.
Yes, it's a kind of a mass or a prayer for the dead done in the synagogue when you have a minyan or a group of elders that can get together to help you mourn for the dead.
So I guess you didn't say the prayer when your mother died.
Well, I didn't know it as well, but I did try and do it. Actually, I wandered around San Francisco with Jack Kerouac and Philip Whalen, and we went into various synagogues, but there was no minyan, so that we couldn't do it. So this is a way of making up about a couple years later.
And this is a couple of years after your mother, Naomi,
yeah, my mother died.
Died
in 55. Incidentally, you know, I sent her the original, a copy of the original manuscript of Howl, which she received about a week before she died, and she wrote me a letter which was postmarked the day she died, which is quoted in Kaddish, in which she said she got my poems. She can't tell whether it's good or bad. My father should judge because he's a poet, but judging from the, but I should, she'd read it, obviously. She said, well, get married, Alan, don't take drugs. And she said, I have the key. The key is in the window. The key is in the sunlight in the window. And then she died of stroke, I think, perhaps hours or within 24 hours of writing the letter. So I received that letter after I had heard that she died.
Huh.
It was like a message from the land of the dead, so to speak.
My guest is Allen Ginsberg. He has a new CD box set called Holy Soul Jelly Roll, featuring recordings of his poems and songs from 1949 to 1993. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Allen Ginsberg. Now, if you had grandfathers who were rabbis, did you say?
Well, scholars, you know, long guys with big black hats and long bearded, long gray beards, who died of cancer from smoking, actually,
in New York
in the 30s.
How did you get to be in your 20s before you heard the prayer for the dead?
Well, we didn't. My mother was communist and my father was socialist.
So you didn't go to a synagogue?
So I did go to synagogue, and I went to Sunday school, or what do you call it, the shul, to learn Hebrew and traditional, prepare for a bar mitzvah, but somehow I asked questions that were resented by the rabbi, and I got kicked out when I was about 8 years old or nine. And I never did understand it, because I thought I was just sort of talking intelligently to him and inquiring. That there must have been an edge of skepticism to it, but there was no tolerance for that at all. Mm. My questions weren't answered, and I was just told to get out. So I've never had very much of a classical Hebrew education.
Your mother was institutionalized several times.
Many, many times. All during my childhood, I had to go out to visit her in Greystone Hospital.
Were you frightened by her madness?
Sometimes sorrowed, sometimes frightened, sometimes stuck with a responsibility I couldn't carry out as a kid, going out alone to see her in a mental hospital when I was 12, 13, 14. Or having to stay home and take care of her while my father was in school teaching. And getting into crisis situations with her that I couldn't handle, actually. It kind of broke my brain, in a way, broke my spirit to some extent.
No, when you started doing hallucinogenics, like LSD, did your hallucinations ever scare you because you'd seen your mother have hallucinations and delusions because of her mental illness?
Well, no, not really. I realized that if everybody began disagreeing with me, I better look around twice and think three times and be pretty sure I knew what I was doing. And so I've been able to be in situations where everybody disagreed, but at the same time maintained my sanity, so to speak, by simply following my heart, really. I have as much a tendency to paranoia as anybody in the United States at this point, but at least I can see it's paranoia, and most people don't see their own paranoia.
That's interesting. So your mother's delusions actually helped you figure out what was real and what wasn't?
Well, I sort of went through the mill already, so I was kind of inoculated. I would say that the experience of having to deal with somebody who was sort of deluded and hallucinating, also voices and all, helped me deal with my own psychic disturbances and also with the psychic disturbances of other people. I seem to be have a kind of tolerance that, you know, in one ear, out the other, or, you know, like, so that I can be with people who are quite disturbed, get disturbed myself, but not so much so that I have to turn my back until, you know, all hope is lost.
Where were you in your performance style in 1964, the year that the recording of Kaddish was made?
I hadn't ever tried to read anything as long as Kaddish, complete. And so there, and I had drunk a little bit, not very much, so I wasn't really drunk, but I was sort of a little keyed up with alcohol so that I was able to loosen my feelings quite a bit. So the only problem there is maintaining control of feelings and not breaking up and crying in the middle of the more moving passages.
Is there a particular section of Kaddish that you've had the most problem with controlling your emotion?
Yeah, there's a the section that begins when I'm visiting my mother in the mental hospital for the last time, and I walk in and I see she's had a stroke, and then there suddenly there's a break in the poem, and there's a kind of lyrical rhapsody. Communist beauty, sit here married in the summer among daisies promised happiness at hand. To the section that ends, oh beautiful garble of my karma. It's really a nice, exquisite, poetic passage, but it's also full of feeling, and it's like a flashback in the midst of tragedy to a happier day. And so there's a lot of emotion buried there from childhood. Also, at the very end, the section, oh mother, what have I left out? Oh mother, what have I forgotten? With your eyes, with your eyes, with your death full of flowers. That has a sort of cumulative emotional buildup that's quite great.
Why don't I play an excerpt of Kaddish? And you wrote this in the late 1950s. The recording we're going to hear from you, Neil Buxett, was made at Brandeis University in 1964.
With your eyes running naked out of the apartment, screaming into the hall, with your eyes being led away by policemen to an ambulance, with your eyes strapped down on an operating table, with your eyes with a pancreas removed, with your eyes of appendix operation, with your eyes of abortion, with your eyes of ovaries removed, with your eyes of shock, with your eyes of lobotomy, with your eyes of divorce, with your eyes of stroke, with your eyes alone, with your eyes, with your eyes, with your death full of flowers.
That's Allen Ginsberg reading an excerpt of Kaddish. It's included on his new box set, Holy Soul, Jelly Roll. Tell us just a little bit about what your life is like now.
Well, I have a little heart trouble and diabetes, but I travel a bit still, and I write quite a bit, and I'm doing a lot of photography and put out several books of photos. And so this year I think I'll do some doodles and have them sort of start drawing. So, you know, just enjoying myself at the age of 68, extending my activities in various directions, but focused primarily on writing and on poetry, with the idea that candor ends paranoia. If I can make my own mind transparent so that people know what I'm really thinking, they don't have anything to be scared of, and they can use it as a mirror for their own minds.
Allen Ginsberg, his new CD box set, Holy Soul Jelly Roll, is on Rhino Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Me, Father Death, I'm flying home. Hey, poor man, you're all alone. Hey, old daddy, I know where I'm going. Father Death, don't cry anymore. Mama's there.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Coming up on this archive edition, we continue our program of Beat Writers. We feature a 1990 interview with poet Gary Snyder. Jack Kerouac based the hero of his novel Dharma Bums on Snyder. Snyder is now best known for his poetry about nature. William Burroughs' 1965 recording of Readings has just been reissued. Ken Tucker has a review of Call Me Burroughs. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Mr. Payback, a new short film that interacts with the audience. The audience gets to choose which humiliations the characters are subjected to. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House of Representatives has approved a sweeping ban on new federal regulations. Supporters say this will help lift heavy government off the backs of small businesses. Opponents worry the public will be threatened by new health and safety violations. Some regulations, like those involving law enforcement or imminent emergencies, are exempted. The bill is now headed for the Senate. Texas Senator Phil Graham has thrown his hat into the ring for the Republican presidential nomination.
I'm running for president because I believe that if we don't change the policy of our government, if we don't change it soon, if we don't change it dramatically, in 20 years we're not going to be living in the same country that we grew up in.
Graham, who's strongly conservative, says his election as president next year would complete the Republican revolution begun last year when the GOP captured control of Congress. President Clinton insists he's not backing away from supporting affirmative action. Mr. Clinton has ordered a review of all such programs.
It is time to look at all these programs which have developed over the last 20 to 25 years and ask ourselves, do they work? Are they fair? Do they achieve the desired objectives? That is very different from trying to use this issue as a political wedge one way or the other. I think it would be a great mistake.
Administration officials say they hope to head off an expected Republican assault on affirmative action. Jesse Jackson is criticizing Mr. Clinton's approach. He says the president should instead defend affirmative action. The Clinton administration has again expressed its opposition to a balanced budget amendment, which is now in the Senate. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
With just days to go before a Senate vote on the balanced budget amendment, the White House sent out three top economic officials and the White House counsel to denounce the measure as bad economic policy. Laura Tyson chairs the National Economic Council.
We're very close to doing something which will have, I think, undermining effects on the Constitution and undermining effects on the economy. So I think it's the right moment to make the case as clearly as we possibly can.
The officials say a balanced budget amendment would exacerbate swings in the economy and increase unemployment. Bill Small at the White House.
House Speaker Newt Gingrich is stepping up his response to Democratic complaints about his conduct. The Speaker charges Democrats are misusing the House ethics system to run a, quote, deliberate smear campaign. He's attacked complaints as bitter moves. He says he'll fight the Democrats with action. He plans to raise the legislative output of the House. The House Ethics Committee is looking at whether Gingrich improperly used tax-deductible contributions to help pay for a college course described as politically oriented. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up nearly 7 points at 4,010. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is down a fraction of a point at 791. This is NPR. 8 U.S. movie companies are suing 2 Beijing stores for selling pirated laser discs of their movies. The official China news service says a Chinese court heard an hour and a half of arguments in the case today, but didn't make a ruling. The suit is lodged by companies like Universal, Paramount, and Columbia. It cites 16 counts of copyright infringement. The suit comes as talks continue between the United States and China on preventing piracy of American movies, music, and computer software. Israeli authorities beefed up security today as more than 130,000 Muslims prayed in Jerusalem's Old City. This is the last Friday of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Israeli officials are always worried about possible violence on Fridays when thousands of Muslims gather to pray together in mosques, especially during the month of Ramadan. This year, the last Friday in Ramadan falls one day before the secular calendar anniversary of the Hebron massacre, in which a Jewish settler killed 30 Muslim worshippers. Despite the month-long closure of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, police allowed Palestinians to enter Israel to attend the Friday prayers. Security was tight, and each worshiper was carefully checked as he entered the area of the Temple Mount, which Palestinians call Haram al-Sharif. Israel has begun easing the closure imposed after a suicide bomber killed 21 Israelis last month. With the end of Ramadan next week, the closure is likely to be eased even further. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Anti-abortion activists deny they're involved in a violent conspiracy against abortion clinics. Three anti-abortion activists testified before a grand jury yesterday in a Washington, D.C. suburb. One told the Washington Post investigators are on a fishing expedition. Another called the grand jury investigation modern-day McCarthyism. Anti-abortion activist Anthony Leake says he wouldn't kill a doctor who performs abortions, but he says if one was murdered, it would be justifiable. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. These days, William Burroughs is familiar to millions of people who've never read a word of his writing for his appearances in TV commercials and the accolades offered to him by generations of rock musicians from Steppenwolf to Sonic Youth and the current wave of so-called spoken word poets. Rhino Records has just re-released Burroughs' first recording, a collection of readings entitled Call Me Burroughs, cut in 1965. Before we hear a review from Ken Tucker, here's Burroughs reading an excerpt of his most famous novel, Naked Lunch.
Meeting of International Conference of Technological Psychiatry. Dr. Fingers Schaefer, the lobotomy kid, rises and turns on the conference the cold blue blast of his gaze. Gentlemen, the human nervous system can be reduced to a compact and abbreviated spinal column. The brain, front, middle, and rear, must follow the adenoid, the wisdom tooth, the appendix. I give you my masterwork, the complete, all-American, de-anxietized man. Blast of trumpets. The man is carried in naked by two Negro bearers who drop him on the platform with sneering brutality. The man wriggles. His flesh turns to a viscid, transparent jelly that drifts away in green mist, unveiling a monster black centipede. Waves of unknown stench fill the room, searing the lungs, grabbing the stomach.
When William Burroughs recorded Call Me Burroughs in the mid-60s, he was the pork pie hat of the avant-garde, a button-down man spewing wild stuff, revelatory in its incoherence. He was closely identified with the Beat movement, with Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, but all Burroughs really shared with them was an alienation from straight society and a regular urge to get high. He liked surrealist imagery and borrowed the Dadaist trick of creating some of his texts by cutting up words and phrases from pre-existing prose. But at the same time, Burroughs has always been an all-American writer. One of his shrewdest borrowings is from the hard-boiled detective novels of Raymond Chandler, whose tone of flat malice he captures perfectly in The Fish Poison Con.
I was traveling with Merritt Incorporated, checking store attendants for larceny with a crew of shoppers, and Bob Schaefer, crew leader, who was an American fascist with Roosevelt jokes. It happens in Iowa, this number comes over the car radio. Old Sal got caught in the fence last spring. And Schaefer said, oh, my God, are we ever in Hicksville? Stopped that night in Pleasantville, Iowa, and our tires gave out. We had no tire rations during the war for such a purpose. And Bob got drunk and showed his badge to the locals in a roadhouse by the river. And I ran into the sailor under a potted palm in the lobby. We hit the local croakers with the fish poison con.
Like the best hard-boiled writers, Burroughs knew that you can imply worlds of emotion if you keep your voice steady while describing terrible things. There's also an element of deadpan comedy in a lot of Burroughs' work. It's what keeps the less attractive aspects of his ideas, his violent misanthropy, his cheap cynicism, from turning too sour.
My trouble began when they decided I was executive timber. It happens like this. A big blonde driller from Dallas picked me out of the labor pool to be his houseboy in a prefabricated bungalow, and in solid. When this friend come down from New York, the driller says, this is the boy I was telling you about. Friend looks me over, chewing his cigar, and says, what are you doing over there with the apes? Why don't you come over here with the board where you belong? And he slips me a long, slimy look. Friend works for the track news agency. We don't report the news, we write it. And next thing I know, they have trapped a gray flannel suit on me, and I am sent to this school in Washington to learn how this writing the news before it happens is done. I suss it as the Mayan caper with an IBM machine. I don't want to be caught short in a gray flannel suit when the lid blows off.
Despite his prim demeanor, Burroughs was really a punk before his time, as inexplicably, overwhelmingly bitter and morose as Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder is now. That's one reason why Burroughs has become an on-screen shill in TV commercials for Nike shoes. The pop culture has caught up with his attitude, and Burroughs' perpetual mood of free-floating animus sells. 30 years ago, Call Me Burroughs must have sounded like a spooky communication from an extremely lively corpse. Heard now, he's just another oddball droning between videos on MTV.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Call Me Burroughs on Rhino Records. We have an interview with poet Gary Snyder after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back in 1990, I interviewed poet Gary Snyder. Allen Ginsberg described Snyder as an American literary cultural hero and wilderness philosopher activist. Snyder became something of a counterculture hero in the 1950s when Jack Kerouac used him as the model for the main character in his novel Dharma Bums. Snyder left San Francisco's beat poetry scene in 1956. He spent 12 years studying Buddhism in Japan and visiting temples in India. When he returned to the States, he settled in Northern California, became active in environmental issues, and continued to write poetry and essays about the natural world. His book Turtle Island won a Pulitzer Prize. Snyder once wrote, "I grew up with the poetry of 20th century coolness, its hard edges and resilient elitism. When it came to writing out of my own experience, most of modernism didn't fit." I asked him why modernism didn't fit his experience.
It's a little hard to put an answer to that except to say modernism is resolutely urban and cosmopolitan and has its spiritual centers in Paris, London, and New York. Nature was considered second class and marginal by the mentality of modernism. Whereas for someone like myself, out at the far edge of the New World, in an area that had only been settled for 40 years and had been a vast forest wilderness for all previous millennia, the experiences are not the same. The things, looking at mountain landscapes, working with wildlife, and also with the physical labor of tools and logging exploitation, the human problems of both Indians and white people around Puget Sound, there's no place in that in the poetry of T.S. Eliot or Wallace Stevens.
And you found what you were looking for more in Chinese and Japanese poems?
It gave me a push in a new direction. It's not as though that was a whole new model to follow by any means, but a Chinese civilization, for example, Chinese culture, opened up an angle to me of the possibility of a high civilization with all of that refinement and sophistication that we expect from a civilization that had a much less exploitative attitude toward the natural world. Now, to be honest, as it turns out in practice, by the time the 20th century rolls around, China and Japan are just as bad as anybody else.
You reprint some of your poems in The Practice of the Wild, and I'm going to ask you to read one of those poems for us, any one of your choosing.
This comes out of the world of the experience of a young white guy logging together with elder Indian working men loggers, American Indian, Native American Indian loggers, with some of the cultural complexities of that. Ray Wells, a big Nisqually, and I each set a choker on the butt logs of two big larch in a thornapple thicket and a swamp. Waiting for the cat to come back, he said, "Yesterday, we gelded some ponies. My father-in-law cut the skin on the balls. He's a Wasco and don't speak English. He grabs a handful of tubes and somehow cuts the right ones. The ball jumps out. The horse screams, but he's all tied up." The caterpillar clanked back down. In the shadow of that racket, diesel and iron tread, I thought of Ray Wells' teepee out on the sage flats, the gelded ponies healing and grazing in the dead white heat.
Poet, essayist, naturalist, and environmentalist Gary Snyder is my guest. You moved to the Bay Area in, what, I think it was 1952?
And 52, yeah.
And it was in the Bay Area that you met Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. I'm wondering if you felt that you found kindred spirits when you met them.
Oh, indeed I did. There weren't many poets around that were working in the kind of idiom that I was trying for. And it was a great pleasure to run onto Allen and then to Jack Kerouac. Prior to that, my only other poetic comrades were Philip Whalen and Lew Welch.
Now, Ginsberg and Kerouac were both urban.
And but widely traveled and widely worked. Both of them had been to sea, both of them had been to Mexico.
So that wasn't a gap for you, the difference between your
No, we
your
we worked out
your, yeah.
we worked it out. I mean, I took them hiking. And they taught me some city smarts.
Like what?
Well, Jack taught me how to sit on the back side of Skid Row and drink Tokay out of a bottle in a brown paper sack.
A useful skill, huh?
Yeah. And how not to get noticed doing that.
Right. Well, that is very useful.
Yeah.
Now you were the main character in Kerouac's book Dharma Bums was based on you.
Yeah, so I'm told.
And well, I want to read you a short description here. He wore a little goatee, strangely oriental-looking, with his somewhat slanted green eyes, but he didn't look like a bohemian at all, and was far from being a bohemian, a hanger-on around the arts. He was wiry, suntanned, vigorous, open, all howdies and glad talk, and even yelling hello to bums on the street, and when asked a question, answered right off the bat from the top or bottom of his mind, I don't know which, and always in a sprightly, sparkling way. Sound like you?
Maybe not quite that cheery. Otherwise, okay.
there's a part in Dharma Bums where the character who I assume to be the Kerouac character, where the character based on you, Jeffrey Ryder, is talking to the character I assume to be based on Kerouac, and is talking to him about drinking too much and warning him about how it's really going to hurt him in the long run. Did you have conversations like that with Kerouac?
Oh, indeed I did. And it's part of the paradox of Jack's life that he could hear that conversation in real life, report it quite accurately in a novel, and then go ahead and keep drinking.
Right, right.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, during the McCarthy era, when you were working for the National Forest Service for a while, you were blacklisted or something? You had to leave?
Because I was fired.
You were fired.
I was fired
on
orders from Washington, D.C.
What exactly had you done or thought politically that got you fired?
I think it was probably because I got my Siemens papers when I was 18 in New York City through the intercession of some officials in the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, which was considered at that time a Communist Party-dominated union. And because friends of mine arranged that for me, they assumed that I was Communist Party or very close to Communist Party. I certainly had many friends who were in the far left there, but my own position had always been that of a cantankerous anarchist, in fact. Nonetheless, you know, that stuck on my record for some years.
Do you think of yourself as a cantankerous anarchist now?
Oh, sure.
And what does that mean?
That means I'm very dubious about the virtue or the legitimacy of the national state as an institution And I do believe that human beings are and can be self-governing in smaller social units. And that for the most part, what we call a national government is a giant protection racket, just like the mafia runs.
What kind of relationship do you have with the people who live near you politically and socially? I don't mean, you know, like going over for a cup of tea or something, but in terms of the environmental interests that you care most about and the things that you need to do to preserve the wildness around you.
We all work together. It is an error to think that people who live in rural areas have an easy time of it and can lay back and groove with nature and that there's no politics. The politics of public lands, of resource extraction, mining in this case, water politics, and the pressures of rapid real estate development and growth are all around us. And we have meetings two or three nights a week.
Do anarchists like yourself like going to meetings three times a week?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I find no contradiction in that.
You don't?
I mean, anarchism simply means self-governing. And self-governing means you got to get out there and learn how to do it.
Your new book is a collection of essays that you've been working on for a long time. Are you still writing poems?
Oh, yeah, I've been writing a lot of poems over the last few years.
Any that are short and that you remember, because I know you probably don't have any recent ones with you, but is there any short poem you'd like to leave us with?
I'd like to leave you with this, which is a little turn on forests and the idea of ecological climax. A virgin forest is ancient, many-breasted, stable at climax.
Gary Snyder, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Poet Gary Snyder recorded in 1990. His latest book, No Nature, New and Selected Poems, was published in 1992. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear the news today about Senator Phil Graham of Texas announcing for president. Graham wants the Republican nomination. We'll also hear about his remarkably successful evening of fundraising last night. In one event, the conservative Texan raised more than $4 million. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about what's happened on Capitol Hill throughout the week, our regular roundup with Elizabeth Arnold and with Major Garrett of the Washington Times. We'll also be hearing about Joseph Spence and a new compact disc that's a tribute to his music from Dazian McLean.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For many years, the writer-producer Bob Gale and the writer-director Robert Zemeckis seemed joined at the hip. Together they made I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars before hitting it big with the Back to the Future films. But Zemeckis and Gale have since gone their separate ways. Zemeckis, of course, made Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Forrest Gump. Gale, meanwhile, has come up with what he calls the world's first interactive movie. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Mr. Payback.
At your theater seat, right where the cup holder should be, there's a kind of joystick, a pistol grip with three buttons, green, orange, and red. You've already bought your ticket. Mine cost $5 at a theater where most features cost $8, and a single ticket lets you sit through the 20-minute Mr. Payback as many times as you want. The lights go down, and you see cheesy-looking shots of skyscrapers from low angles. That's supposed to mean it's the future. Then you hear,
Payback. Mr. Payback. Who is Mr. Payback? A whispered legend. A prototype justice machine. Human once, now legally dead, yet very much alive. Part man, part cyborg, and 100% Avenger. Operating secretly from a forgotten part of town. Assisted by his lovely hacker helpmate, Gwen. And accessible via the Internet Underground to those in need. Mr. Payback is said to take all revenge personally. And with pride. His motto, D-P-M-O.
Don't piss me off.
What sets Mr. Payback apart from lesser men is mainly his index finger, a plaster of Paris-looking thing that opens up to dispense crazy glue, darts, fire, noxious gases, and so forth. His other great weapon is, I'm afraid, his superhuman flatulence. Mr. Payback is played by Billy Warlock, who used to star in TV's Baywatch. He's perky and cute and bland. There are three main plots, which are also bland but not perky or cute, and the audience chooses which one to watch. The one involving the pretty girl who's being sexually harassed at college usually gets the most votes, but many people stay for a second run-through, and then they're encouraged to select the plot about a poor Latino whose land is being taken over by an evil town official. The storylines are simple, but I couldn't follow them anyway, for two reasons. One, the characters are so inane that they deflect attention instead of attracting it, and two, the movie itself urges you to forget about the story and concentrate on other things, like the choices you're expected to make with your pistol grip and the points you can rack up with certain votes. If an audience totals up enough points, you're rewarded with a bonus scene at the end of the movie. Every 2 minutes or so, the bottom of the screen lights up with choices. The words gross moment, for instance, will appear, and you'll be asked to choose solid, liquid, or gas. At this point, the audience of 20 people or so that I saw the movie with went into a frenzy of plastic button pushing. The whole theater sounded like chattering teeth. Numbers on the screen tell you which choice is winning, and finally the one with the most points triumphs. Gross moment liquid, if memory serves, had to do with a large emission of mucus. The movie is all about gross moments. In an obvious attempt to appeal to teenagers without alarming their elders, Mr. Payback is bloodless, and the revenge its hero takes is always a matter of embarrassing evildoers or subjecting them to onslaughts of bodily fluids. So, will this thing fly? I can't imagine how. It requires no skill on the part of the audience, so it's much less engrossing than a video game, and because its storytelling is incredibly feeble, and has to be to accommodate all these choices, nothing on the screen ever seems worth watching. Movies aren't a democracy, and the decisions an audience can vote for are never going to be as interesting as the ones a skilled filmmaker makes. Mr. Payback proves that, and yet a similar kind of wrong-headed democracy comes into play in Hollywood, when the studios change the plots and endings of movies in response to the votes of preview audiences. Next time that happens, some studio honcho should be subjected to, well, you decide, solid, liquid, or gas.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, rebuilding Chechnya, the Russian breakaway state that's been pounded by the Russian military. We talk with Fred Cuny, a disaster relief expert who helped restore water and gas lines in Sarajevo and is now assessing the damage in Chechnya. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.